Picture a private jet spiraling through war-torn Libyan skies in early 2011, shadowed by a NATO drone. Inside sits Ian Tyler, CEO of Vitol, the world's largest oil trading company you've probably never heard of. His mission sounds reckless: supply fuel to cash-strapped rebels fighting Gaddafi. Vitol's exposure eventually balloons past $1 billion, enough to sink the entire company if the rebels lose. Yet Taylor keeps the oil flowing, with tankers slipping into ports under darkness while artillery thunders nearby. This gamble reveals something extraordinary about commodity traders: the invisible titans who ensure your morning coffee reaches your cup, your car has gasoline, and factories keep humming. They thrive where others flee, operating in war zones, dealing with dictators, and moving resources across a planet that desperately needs them. Five oil trading houses control nearly a quarter of world petroleum demand. Seven agricultural traders manage half the planet's grains. Glencore alone handles a third of global cobalt, yet most people couldn't name a single one. These modern merchant adventurers have quietly shaped history, helping Saddam Hussein dodge UN sanctions, keeping Castro's Cuba afloat, selling wheat to Soviets during the Cold War, and raising billions for Putin's allies, all while generating staggering personal fortunes in near total secrecy. While humans have traded resources since prehistoric times, the modern industry emerged from 19th century technological breakthroughs. Steamships made bulk shipping economically viable. Telegraphs enabled near-instant global communication. After World War II devastated the industry, post-war reconstruction created immense opportunities as government controls gradually lifted. The stage was set for a new breed of trader to emerge, someone willing to go anywhere, deal with anyone, and risk everything. When Theodore Weiser approached the Soviet border in 1954, terror gripped him. As a former German POW imprisoned on the Eastern Front, entering Stalin's USSR felt like walking back into a nightmare. But his Hamburg fuel company was hemorrhaging money, and desperation overrides fear. In Moscow, he sat across from Evgeny Gurov, head of Soviet oil exports, under KGB surveillance. Despite shipping companies refusing to touch Soviet crude, Weiser secured something priceless: a contact behind the Iron Curtain. This signaled a seismic shift. Commodity traders positioned themselves to profit from anyone, anywhere. Their philosophy? Business is supreme. Political matters are not business. Born Marcel David Reich in 1934 Antwerp, Mark Rich fled Nazi Europe before reaching America in 1941. Growing up as a perpetual outsider, he developed business hunger and chameleon-like adaptability. At 19, Rich joined Philip Brothers in the mailroom. His multilingual skills and fierce intelligence quickly distinguished him. His first major coup? Cornering the mercury market by anticipating government stockpiling. In 1968, he discovered a secret oil pipeline connecting Israel and Iran, selling Iranian oil throughout Europe. His business and his hobbies were one and the same, recalled one employee, remembering Rich poring over telexes late into the night, utterly consumed. The 1973 oil crisis tripled crude prices overnight as Middle Eastern nations seized Western oil fields. Independent traders like Rich saw their opening. Oil trading suddenly eclipsed metals in profitability. Despite Philip Brothers' 1973 earnings jumping 75%, Mark Rich and partner Pinky Green faced trading restrictions. When leadership rejected their compensation demands, Rich confronted Ludwig Jesselson during his February 1974 ski holiday, demanding $1 million to split with Green. Jesselson refused. Rich quit immediately. Jesselson was devastated. "They were like my own sons. I brought them up from nothing, and then they turned their backs on me." On April 3, 1974, Mark Rich & Co. launched in Zug, Switzerland, with five partners and $650,000 in capital. Profits exploded: $28 million in 8 months, $50 million the next year, $200 million by 1976, surpassing Philip Brothers. Rich was perfectly positioned to dominate the transformed oil market. One Friday evening in the early 1980s, Jamaica's minister, Hugh Hart, faced catastrophe. The country had run out of money and oil. The central bank couldn't fund a scheduled shipment, meaning gas stations would close nationwide by Sunday. Desperate, Hart called trader Mark Rich at 2 a.m. in Switzerland. Within 24 hours, Rich diverted a Venezuelan crude shipment to Jamaica, averting disaster. This $10 million oil delivery without a contract demonstrated commodity traders' immense power. As resource nationalism swept developing nations in the 1970s-80s, newly independent states seized control of natural resources from Western companies. Traditional lenders avoided these unstable countries, but traders stepped in as financial lifelines. Over three decades, Mark Rich Plesko and later Glencore provided nearly $1 billion in financing to Jamaica, advancing payments for bauxite, lending money to meet IMF requirements, financing Jamaica's purchase of Exxon's refinery, even funding Olympic teams. When opposition politician Michael Manley returned to power in 1989, promising to investigate Rich's deals, he discovered the trader's formidable influence. Officials in Venezuela and Canada pressured Jamaica to maintain relations. Financial desperation forced Manley to announce a new $45 million loan from Mark Rich. The traders had become the last bank in town, financing desperate governments and gaining unprecedented influence over national economies. While Rich built his empire on relationships and physical oil, a new breed emerged in the 1990s. Andy Hall of Fibro Energy made $600 to $800 million during the 1990 Gulf War through market analysis rather than handshake deals. Spotting an oversupplied market in early 1990, Hall bought physical oil, stored it on chartered supertankers, and sold futures contracts. Using Salomon Brothers credit, he accumulated 37 million barrels worth $600 million. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August, oil prices doubled to $40 per barrel, transforming Hall's tankers into cash machines. This shift reflected oil trading's financialization. Paper barrels allowed price bets without handling physical oil. Wall Street banks like Goldman Sachs became Wall Street refiners, using cheap funding to dominate trading. Meanwhile, Mark Rich Plesko faced collapse. Rich installed his personal lawyer Bob Thomajohn as gatekeeper, forcing experienced traders to take orders from an outsider. He refused to distribute shares or relinquish control. On major decisions, I have the final say. Claude Dolphin resigned in July 1992, followed by others. A disastrous zinc market corner lost $172 million. The oil team resigned en masse in February 1993. On September 1, 1994, Mark Rich Plesko became Glencore International. Rich was stunned. I was weak, and the others could sense it. They held the knife to my throat. In June 2001, Mick Davis drafted plans for Xstrata from his London home. The 43-year-old South African, hired by Glencore CEO Ivan Glasenberg, predicted commodity prices would surge after years of decline, driven by China's industrialization. His forecast proved prophetic. Deng Xiaoping's 1978 reforms unleashed three decades of 10% annual growth. Around 2001, China hit the commodity sweet spot, GDP per capita of $4,000, when countries experience explosive demand through industrialization. Between 1998-2018, emerging markets drove 92% of increased metals consumption and 67% of energy growth. The industry couldn't meet this surge. Prices exploded. Oil rose from $10 in 1998 to over $50 by 2004, while nickel quadrupled. Commodity-rich nations prospered and bought more Chinese goods, accelerating global growth. The fourth modern supercycle had begun. In May 2011, Glencore's traders arrived at headquarters before dawn for a revelation. The company was going public. The prospectus exposed staggering wealth. CEO Glasenberg owned 18.1%, worth $9.3 billion. The IPO minted seven billionaires and revealed an industry that had operated in shadows for decades. This transparency marked the beginning of the end. In 2014, BNP Paribas terminated its relationship with Trafigura and pulled $2 billion in credit after pleading guilty to violating U.S. sanctions. Investigations multiplied. Vittel, Trafigura, and Glencore faced allegations of paying $31 million in bribes to Petrobras employees. Vittel admitted to bribing officials in Brazil, Ecuador, and Mexico, paying $164 million in penalties. Beyond legal troubles, structural challenges emerged. Democratized information eroded their advantage, trade liberalization reversal threatened their model, and climate change struck at their core business, with oil demand potentially peaking around 2030. Yet COVID-19 demonstrated their continued importance. As markets collapsed, they deployed billions at lightning speed as buyers of last resort when no one else could match their capacity. The old guard is passing. Mark Rich died in 2013, Claude Dauphin in 2015, Ian Taylor in 2020. Their high-risk style faces extinction under pressure from banks, regulators, and changing expectations. But predictions of the industry's death are premature. As long as resources move globally, traders will exploit inefficiencies and deploy unique financial firepower. The commodity trader's story reveals that essential systems, the flows of oil, grain, metals, sustaining modern life, operate beyond public view, controlled by companies most people have never heard of. Understanding who controls these flows means understanding real power. The resources fueling our lives are always for sale. The question is, who's buying, who's selling, and at what cost?